Welcome to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, here in studio this morning with Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. Good morning, Malia. It's good to see you.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for being here. I understand you traversed some weather for us.
Last night, I traversed some very dangerous weather in the Poconos on my way home to Kingston from Maryland. And then this morning, the weather isn't dangerous yet, but I did encounter some snowflakes on my way north to Albany.
It's supposed to be flurries today, but high winds, so do be careful out there. Trees, power lines, etc. And if you are driving, remember to turn your headlights on. It's one of my advice and peeve things when it's barely visible but is daytime and people's auto lights don't come on. Turn your headlights on. It'll help people see you and keep people a little bit safer. Also in the rain too. But a lot of times, I mean, I know a lot of cars, the lights just do go on, but keep an eye on it. It's my advice. Also in studio, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert. Hi, Sienna.
Hi, thanks for having me. And good tip. I was just thinking, I don't think I've ever touched my light switch. Because they do everything. So I'm like, that's a good tip.
Can you adjust your mic a little so it's in front of you?
There
you
go. Perfect. Thanks.
Yeah, much better. Thanks. And former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is here. Hello, Mike.
Hi. I'm happy to be here. I didn't have any too many problems getting over here today. It's just really cold out. I'm getting tired of the cold.
Well, it is still December. You've got a few more months to likely
ski
tolerate
season.
It. But I understand. Right. It's going to be very, very deeply cold the next few days. A lot of wind today. But this is the Northeast. Yeah. We know where we live. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let us begin this morning with yesterday's meeting between President Donald Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They met at Mar-a-Lago yesterday, and after the meeting, they presented a united front while offering few details on the substance of their talks or the next steps in the Gaza peace plan. Trump did say the United States would back Israeli strikes on Iran if that country continued with its ballistic missile and nuclear weapon program. That was from sort of the end of the address. Wasn't exactly an address, but the end of their presentation. He mentioned that he would back Israeli strikes on Iran. For Trump, the meeting was an opportunity to take another victory lap for orchestrating the Gaza ceasefire, however tenuous it may be. He's repeatedly overstated it as peace in the Middle East that he is responsible for. On the possibility that Turkey could play a role in post-war Gaza, which Israel staunchly opposes, Trump praised the leaders of both countries who have a bitter relationship between the two of them. I'm with him all the way, Donald Trump said of President Erdogan of Turkey, and I'm with Bibi all the way. Nothing's going to happen. Mr. Netanyahu, in his fifth visit with Mr. Trump this year, seemed to struggle to find new ways to say the president was the best friend Israel had ever had in the White House, at one point going so far as to praise the meal the American leader has just served him. The Israeli government also bestowed another award on President Trump, the latest in a trend of foreign leaders and organizations seemingly trying to win over the president with new honors. At the start of the bilateral meeting, Israel's education minister, Yoav Kitch, called in to share that Mr. Trump would be awarded the Israel Prize, which is traditionally given to Israeli citizens in various categories of the arts and sciences. After Trump suggested that Mr. Netanyahu would soon win a prize of his own, a presidential pardon in his long-running corruption trial, Mr. Trump has urged Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, to grant Mr. Netanyahu a pardon. So a lot of little pieces of stories, maybe nothing really accomplished, but, you know, still in communication and very important when world leaders meet. Let us discuss. We'll start with you, Malia.
Well, I think what this meeting has shown is that President Trump, in his foreign policy towards the Middle East, remains less focused on the internal politics of Israel, and I'm categorizing Gaza as an internal issue in this sense. He's less interested in that, although he likes the praise he gets for ostensibly bringing peace to or helping broker this peace agreement. But he's less interested in that than he is in the larger geopolitics of the region, Iran has dominated for a long time. And so him talking about being behind Netanyahu all the way, of course, there's implications for what happens in Gaza with the Palestinians. But I think that the Trump foreign policy team is focused on this bigger issue of Iran, which continues to be a state sponsor of terrorism, and how to deter Iran from continuing to project its power throughout the Middle East in all kinds of dangerous ways. I mean, Hezbollah has been degraded to a certain extent, but certainly not hasn't been disempowered everywhere that it operates. And it's a very dangerous organization, and it is still the foreign policy of Iran. Death to America and death to Israel is still the official foreign policy of Iran. So I think in terms of the Trump administration's priorities, Iran continues to be the priority when speaking with Israel. And so President Trump is willing to, I guess, set aside for the moment or look past whatever is happening from his point of view, whatever's happening in Gaza, and leave that to the Israelis, and just hope that there's some kind of progress that he can point to, like minuscule progress towards rebuilding Gaza. But in terms of the Trump administration's larger goals, there doesn't have to be a lot of progress in Gaza for him to be able to point to it and say things are going okay. We're solving this larger problem of stability in the Middle East. I think like this is me trying to interpret right. Trump administration foreign policy. So that's my take on how the meeting unfolded yesterday.
Mike?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that analysis. The focus on Iran seems to be coming up again, you know, after reports this week, quoting intelligence sources, some news agencies have reported that they're already building up their nuclear capacity and closing in on the ability to make a nuclear weapon, which it would be very, very counter to, peace in the Middle East long term. So yes, it does seem like it's a bigger, broader interest that the U.S. has, and they would like to keep Gaza out of the news, it seems like, and let that be Israel's responsibility and all that. What fascinates me is this dynamic between Netanyahu and Trump. You know, it seems like an awkward, alliance. They seem like bros, but it seems very odd and complicated. They kind of need each other, but I think Netanyahu, according to various pundits who follow it more closely than I, it really needs Trump. This notion that Trump is pushing for Netanyahu to have a pardon by the president in Israel. I think the last time he was in Israel, Trump called for that with Herzog right there and looked right at him and said, "Can't you do a pardon? Can't you do that?" and put pressure on him. And there were stories that said that's not, they don't have the unilateral presidential veto power to forgive crimes the way that the United States president does. And it just, it seems like they say nice things about each other. Netanyahu bestows awards on Trump, but I don't trust it. It seems like it's very, very tentative and fragile, and he knows that if he makes Trump angry, it could be really devastating to his own political future, Netanyahu.
I will say, just to piggyback on that a little bit, I did look into this because I was curious when I read the article about what is the pardon policy in Israel. And apparently the president receives recommendations from the Ministry of Justice in terms of pardon. So it's not just like, using a pin, whichever kind of pin that is. We know that's controversial here in the U.S. and pardoning somebody. But what was interesting to me was, same as you, Mike, is I was looking at the dynamics because I thought it was kind of going to be where Trump was kind of pushing him, like he's been the last few months, pushing him on things such as, let's go to the next step in the ceasefire. How are we going to get this done? I was thought maybe we hear a little bit more about West Bank and their disagreement on West Bank and what's happening there. But none of that happened. And it just seemed like he wanted to run a victory lap. And that was disappointing to see that. Not surprising, but disappointing to see that was where we were at with it. Because what's happening right now in Gaza is, you know, we have children suffering from the cold and what's happening there, and children dying. So we really want to see, and Hamas is not looking to hand over arms because, as you know, because the strikes are still happening. So it's kind of, it doesn't look like anything's moving in Gaza. And there's, and we're going to talk later, I know, about humanitarian aid. But
yeah, we'll add that to the topic. Maybe even now is a fine time.
But no one's, like I said, no one's surprised that wasn't the humanitarian aspect of what's going on, and moving the ceasefire forward doesn't seem to be in talks at all. Where's the Board of Peace? Where's that? So it's just disheartening.
Let us add to the conversation, since we are discussing Israel and Gaza, that Israel's parliament also yesterday passed new legislation formally removing diplomatic immunity from the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees. The legislation could potentially expose the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, widely known as UNRWA, to legal action in Israeli courts. It also bars Israeli companies from providing water, electricity, or financial services to UNRWA institutions. The law will also allow Israeli authorities to expropriate two UNRWA offices in East Jerusalem. UN agencies are typically entitled to diplomatic immunity enshrined in an international convention, which Israel ratified as part of their role as neutral mediators. Israel already banned UNRWA last year, alleging that Hamas had fundamentally compromised its Gaza branch. UNRWA says Israel is trying to discredit the agency, which provides education and health care to millions of Palestinians across the Middle East. The group's officials say Israel has provided no proofs for its claims of sweeping misconduct by its employees. After the Israel-Hamas war began on October 7th, 2023, UNRWA played a key role in distributing food, medicine, and other aid to Palestinians during the humanitarian crisis, the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The agency's schools were converted into shelters hosting displaced Palestinians. That changed after last year's ban, which severely hobbled the UN agency's efforts in the West Bank and Gaza. Israel stopped providing new visas for UNRWA staff members to travel to Israel and Gaza, and as a result, its East Jerusalem offices are now largely vacant. Israel accuses Hamas, which seized full control of Gaza in 2007, of extensively infiltrating UNRWA. The Israeli military has said more than 10% of the group's employees are members of Hamas and other armed groups, but have not been able to provide evidence, and a lot of intelligence does report that that is likely not the case. Malia?
Well, I can't argue with the veracity of the reports or not. The issue, as I see it, is that humanitarian aid, which whether Hamas had infiltrated UNRWA or not, UNRWA was, I think, the largest provider of humanitarian aid in Gaza. And so if it's no longer there, then there's a huge void to be filled. And something else needs to be created to fill that void if UNRWA isn't going to be it, if we don't want mass starvation to occur, which is what's happening right now. And so it's I think, Sienna, you said it was disappointing that Netanyahu and Trump didn't really talk about this yesterday. It would have been a really great opportunity for them to take some kind of pro-human stance.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was just it seemed like all geopolitics all the time with the two, and with some currying favor with Trump as they throw in these potential awards for him. But it's a huge humanitarian crisis. These are two world leaders who are in a position to do something about it, and that wasn't on their. Well, maybe they talked about it behind closed doors, but it's not part of what the message that they wanted to share with the world afterwards is what they're doing. They did not want to publicly show that this is a priority for them, which we have to conclude that it isn't, since they're not. They didn't bring it up.
I'll say real quick, and this is the man that wants the Nobel Peace Prize, by the way. Like, I always think these are these opportunities to show the human aspect of yourself and to make these big, you know, calls. And he doesn't. He fails every time when it comes to this. But I will say, I looked into this, and in October 2025, I want to read this, there was a lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court here in Manhattan where victims and families of October 7th, they sought over $1 billion damages from UNRWA, alleging that the agency aided Hamas and funnel funds, very similar to what's going on in Israel right now. And the judge dismissed this lawsuit because they said that UNRWA has absolute immunity from a suit because they are a subsidiary organ of the United Nations. And that's just how it's been treated. That's how they're treated. And I'm not, when I say I'm not surprised, is because the Trump administration filed a statement against UNRWA saying that they should not have this immunity. So it's, I'm not surprised that they wouldn't go up against Israel on their stance on this. But that has, it's very interesting, the legal implications of this. Like, what does that mean if they're saying, if a domestic law, there is a domestic Israel law saying that UNRWA is, you know, doing X, Y, and Z, and so therefore they're not allowed to be here. And I think they had expropriation, so like they could, they're going to get their lands and move them out, basically. I don't know what that means in terms of international law. Like, I'm thinking international law, UN has always had this kind of immunity in different countries. That's how they operate. And for a domestic law to come in and to kind of try to wipe that away, what are the implications if they do that in different countries? Like, what are the long-term implications as well? That's what I was thinking about.
I'm impressed with what you said, Malia, about how it didn't come up in their conversation publicly. I really doubt that either of them wants to acknowledge the pain and the devastation that continues in Gaza. And to talk about it and to talk about supplying aid to the people in Gaza only would be formal recognition about how bad it is. Mm. And it's a lot easier to talk about your enemy, Iran, who, you know, is the enemy of Israel, unquestionably, and the United States also. And that is something that unites us. And issues about the treatment of people in Palestine in general, but in Gaza, have really divided Americans and have really divided people all over the globe about Israel. And so I think to even acknowledge it publicly, let alone talk about it and talk about ways to remedy a problem that they just don't want to highlight and don't even want to acknowledge. And it is especially devastating because of the reports about the continued starvation, et cetera.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. I'm Sarah LaDuke here with Malia Dumont, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Mike Spain. Again, you can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. We will return to this topic and share some of your letters after this newscast from the BBC. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke here with Malia Dumont, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Mike Spain. We are discussing the latest in the meeting between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel and Israel's de-sanctioning of the UNRWA services in Gaza. We have a letter here from Asher who says, "Remind me who has been bombed by a nuclear power in the Middle East. Were they countries that actually had full-blown nuclear weapons programs? Has any of the full-blown operational nuclear weapons holding countries been bombed by another nuclear power? Nuclear powers in the Middle East, namely Israel, and through its projection of force, the U.S. and the U.K. are the largest disruptors to peace. Not to defend Iran's form of foreign policy or Hamas, but you can't help but expect belligerents like that to exist, given the posture and history of overt and official state violence and the threat of the nuclear hammer from the West." That's from Asher. Reactions?
Make a good point. I mean, when you talk about nuclear capability, nuclear arms capability, many countries have gone that way. I mean, the few that have nuclear weapons have gone that way more as a deterrent, and you could argue it's a deterrent, but it's not. When you have crazy people with hatred sort of in their mantra, access to nuclear arms, it's frightening and scary, and you know, the more people that have them, the more chance it is that they'll be used, and that's terrifying.
We interrupted your train of thought to go to the break, Mike. Do you remember?
Oh, no, I was just finishing saying that it's especially painful that the president of the United States and the prime minister of Israel would get together and talk and not even acknowledge the terrible situation that continues to exist in Gaza and in parts of Palestine. That's all.
Okay. We will, of course, continue focusing on that story as matters progress and meetings take place and press conferences are strange. We'll move now to the drone strike on the port in Venezuela. This from the New York Times. The CIA conducted a drone strike on a port facility in Venezuela last week, according to people briefed on the operation, a development that suggests an aggressive new phase of the Trump administration's pressure campaign against the Maduro government has begun. The strike was on a dock where U.S. officials believe that Tren de Aragua, a Venezuelan gang, was storing narcotics and potentially preparing to move drugs onto boats. No one was on the dock at the time and no one was killed, they said, but the strike is the first known American operation inside Venezuela. The details of the strike, which were reported by CNN, fleshed out an attack that President Trump had already discussed openly, despite the secrecy that typically surrounds CIA operations. The Venezuelan government did not directly comment Monday on the strike or Mr. Trump's remarks, but Diosdado Cabello, Venezuela's interior minister, denounced months of imperial madness, quote, end quote, harassment, threats, attacks, persecution, robberies, piracy, and murders, end quote. The intensifying campaign, pardon me, unites two particular targets of the Trump administration, again the gang previously mentioned, Tren de Aragua, and the Maduro government, while the Trump administration has alleged there are close ties between them. The CIA regularly conducted drone strikes against terrorist targets in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and elsewhere during the Obama administration, but the agency is not known to have conducted strikes recently, leaving operations to the U.S. military. It is not clear at this time if the drone used in the mission was owned by the CIA or borrowed from the U.S. military, and military officials declined to comment on Monday. The Pentagon has stationed several MQ-9 Reaper drones, which carry Hellfire missiles, at bases in Puerto Rico as part of the pressure campaign. An operation on land in Venezuela, Malia.
So I'm sure that a lot of people, are perplexed, I guess is one word for it, about why the seemingly sudden focus on Venezuela. Now, this drone strike is the latest emphasis of that. And I'm going to refer people to a document that they may have heard of, but sounds pretty boring and is usually not dissected in the national news that much, and that's the National Security Strategy. The Trump administration released a new National Security Strategy recently, and you can see its influence in these actions that the Trump administration is taking towards Venezuela. The purpose of a National Security Strategy is to and it's an unclassified document, so you can look this up and read the whole thing yourself. It's to list the priorities for the United States as it pursues its path in the world. And this National Security Strategy, one of its unique aspects is that it refocuses the United States on the Western Hemisphere and away from, despite the meeting with Netanyahu and with Zelensky, but refocuses U.S. efforts on securing the Western Hemisphere. Venezuela has long been problematic for the United States. It didn't start with the Trump administration. It is a nexus for Iranian terrorist activity in the Western Hemisphere. Under the leadership, the corrupt leadership of its current and some of its former governments, has become a base for transnational criminal activity. And these are not new aspects, and it also has the largest oil reserves. So it's a critically important place that is run by a corrupt government, and criminal elements dominate and take advantage of the lawlessness there. So that is not a new situation. What is new is that the Trump administration has decided that that action needs to be taken against this, that like more direct action. And so that's why they've been stopping the oil tankers. And I think the goal is to get rid of the current head of the government, with the idea that that then they would the United States would be able to influence how a new government might come into being that would be less hospitable to all these different criminal elements, would prevent Venezuela from continuing to be this this nexus of transnational criminal activity, and whether or not the U.S. would get more access to the oil, I'm sure that's one of the goals, that it would prevent Venezuela's oil resources from being used to prop up the communist regime in Cuba, for example, because reduced price oil from Venezuela is one of the things that helps keep the Cuban regime going. So there are a number of reasons why the Trump administration is focusing on Venezuela, and I assume that Trump also would hope that there would be some kind of deterrent effect in the region, that other governments of other countries in South America would get the message that the Trump administration is going to act against governments that are seen to turn a blind eye to transnational criminal organizations. Whether this is notice I'm just again trying to interpret what the Trump administration is doing. Why are they focusing on Venezuela? I am not a legal expert. Whether these actions are going against some kind of international law, I can't comment on that. But drone strikes are not a new thing either. Again, I'm not advocating for them. I'm not saying it's okay. It's just like these are tools that have been at the United States' disposal that have been used more in other parts of the world. And now it's a lot closer to home because that's where the Trump administration has decided to focus its efforts.
Mike?
Yeah, it certainly appears, just dovetailing on what you're saying, Malia, it certainly appears that in many, many ways the U.S. is poking, the Maduro government and Venezuela. Drone strikes, and of course, I think up to 112 people have been killed on boats in the Caribbean by the U.S. military. And we're claiming that they're trafficking drugs to the U.S., although there's little evidence of that. And, we've talked about this, but, wouldn't it make sense to capture some of those boats, find out the sources, and to turn some of those who are transporting these drugs, if that is what they're doing, so turn them, put pressure on them, and go back and be more effective in stopping drug trafficking, if that is indeed what really is going on. I mean, all of it seems to be just poke them any way you can. And I guess you have to think about it's not just Donald Trump at all. I mean, it's the United States has held a heavy hand in Latin America for the last century. I mean, we've backed certain governments against local democracies. We've backed certain governments with military aid. We've propped up dictators. We've, gone in and defended U.S. companies that, have major interests in South and Central American countries over the years. You know, we sent the Marines to, I think, Nicaragua. It's a history where we've tried to control these countries, tried to move them, let them supply us with whatever resources, whether it's bananas or oil or whatever else they have, and want them to just be beholding to us. And it's a sad history. Trump is really just continuing it. He's stepping it up, and you know,
doubling down on it.
Doubling down, yeah. I mean, but one of the reasons that these places like Cuba and Venezuela thrive is because we put them down and then they get aid. They help each other. They, you know, we don't encourage democracies. We like military strongmen and like to keep them in power when they're the military strongmen that we like, and it backfires on you, and it causes civil war like there has been in Venezuela, like there were throughout Central America. El Salvador had a civil war for 20 years that was fueled by U.S. aid, and it's not working, and we're just seeing more of it, and I think. You know, it's not a surprise, but it looks like we're going to be at war with Venezuela at one point soon. Whether it's officially declared a war, we're going to be taking military action in Venezuela to protect the U.S. From whatever it is we accuse them of. And, you know.
Panel at WAMC.org to participate in the conversation. We will return with more of the roundtable panel after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Your panel this morning, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, who we've yet to hear from regarding Venezuela. You're up, Sienna.
Thanks. Well, this is where I land on this. I think, you know, like you said, there's been strikes. We've done this before. You've seen strikes in, you know, Pakistan and what have you. I think what's surrounding this whole Venezuelan issue with the boats and now most recently the docks is people don't understand why it's happening. And I think that lack of clarity and the continuity of it happening and the people dying, we want answers about that. And so what I've been wrestling with and what I know I don't have an answer to is you're waiting for the congressional oversight, the war powers resolution to come in, right? Everyone's waiting for that to kick in. Now you did it a couple times. Now, you know, when does that 60-day window end? What happens with that? And we know what the administration's position is on that, is that these are, you know, happening in waters. They're not technically land. It's not against a person. But now we're getting closer to the dock. And now it's not a military action. Now it might be the CIA action. So it's constantly this moving ball. And everyone wants that oversight. And you could tell from weeks ago, I think, was it 3 weeks ago when we were discussing what was happening? When they went back with the second strike to, you know,
right.
the amount of fervor around it. And so I think that's where the frustration comes from, this strike that distinguishes it from other things that we've seen happening in the Middle East, have you, during the Afghanistan turmoil, is that this is happening so close to home, which we understand why, because of what you said. But also it feels like there's no good rationale when their only rationale is the war against drugs, right? Even what you were telling us earlier about the national security strategy seems more well-founded, and maybe they could expound on that. But I think that's where you're seeing this fervor and why this it keeps coming up in the media is because the basis is I don't think the country understands what's happening, and the war against drugs doesn't seem like enough to justify it. And so I think that's why you have this kind of we're having this kind of push and pull. You know, I mean, I think in the country about this situation, because everyone can agree that Venezuela is, you know, not, you know, is a terrible place, is a not enemy of the state. I don't want to come off as like Trump, like these. But, you know, it's not ideal. But we're just really concerned about this idea that the executive branch, like just very simple government 101, the executive branch is bombing boats. In open water, allegedly for the war on drugs, and we don't have any evidence of that. And that, just at its basic, is just feels wrong.
Right. And like, why is this the way that is going to solve the problems that are represented by what we've been talking about? I mean, and it gets back to what you were saying too, Mike. I mean, as someone who has works in intelligence. You know, like I'm very interested in the networking. Like that's a big aspect of what intelligence analysts do is trying to network, understand who's behind this, where does it extend to, and when you're just destroying things, then you're actually losing some intelligence possibilities there, and the ability to to draw that back to, you know, where is the leader of the network? How is it managed? Where are the flows coming from? I mean, if all you're doing is just it becomes more of a deterrent action for the frontline drug runners who are not the ones who are managing the whole system. The people who are profiting from this, who are managing it, are going to find some other way. I mean, I'm not trying to create sympathy for the drug runners, but they're like Putin soldiers, you know, being thrown into a front line, and he doesn't care how many of them are killed. You know, they're getting paid somewhat, but I share your confusion about this,
yeah,
Sienna, about, you know, why is this the chosen method, other than just we want to demonstrate American power and might, but it doesn't actually really help, I don't think, help solve the problem.
And I think what they fail to realize
is what is the problem? Pardon me.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Just what is that problem?
So I look at Venezuela there's some rough parallels to be drawn actually with Afghanistan, mm-hmm. which is a lawless state. The Taliban was running Afghanistan. They didn't have any close relationship with Al Qaeda, but they allowed Al Qaeda to operate there, and other it became a haven for terrorists. And so it may be that Maduro doesn't have a direct connection to this what's it called, Tren de Aguas, but certainly he knows they're operating. He's allowed this environment to take place, and it becomes a cancer for the entire region that Hezbollah is operating out of Venezuela, that all these transnational criminal organizations are using it as a base. So that, to me, is the problem. Are you solving that problem by doing a drone strike on a dock? Probably not.
Not even close.
Yeah.
Boats. Yeah.
Yeah. Or the boats. It's just, I think that you've hit the nail. Like, if that's the underlying issue, but that's not what they're telling us, right? They're not even getting close to that. They're saying that it's because of the war on drugs, and they're bringing the drugs and this boat is coming all the way to maybe the Florida coast and landing and giving the drugs out. And we know that's not the way it happens. Anybody who watches one episode of Ozark or Breaking Bad can figure this out. Like, this is not, it's a deeper network that goes into bringing drugs into this country, and it's more complex. And so to see them with a network that's so complex, and we know this, and to simplify it into bombing a boat or a dock feels just very disconnected. Does that make, that's what I'm trying to say.
Teresa wrote in to panel@wamc.org and says, "We want the oil, period. We're becoming the transnational criminal organization." We heard from Liz, who says, "Drone strikes have not been approved by Congress, and they don't always happen. Congress passed the authorization to use U.S. military force that enabled George W. Bush and Barack Obama to use military force in Iraq and Afghanistan." We heard from Mike, who says, "It's very obvious that the main reason Trump is doing this is that it's easier to control the Americas than it is to help Europe or elsewhere. Economics 101. Priscilla wrote in and said, "It seemed that in addition to greed for Venezuelan resources, Trump wants to be able to claim that the U.S. is now in a state of war so he can declare martial law here and continue to implement Project 2025. Thank you so much for your daily discussions. We listen every day that we can." What do we think about that projection?
Oh, that this is to declare a state of war.
In power.
You know, I don't think it's that. I mean, you know, if we were to declare war on Venezuela, it would be a very, that doesn't happen anyway. We don't declare war. We just go to war. You know, you don't need a legal declaration of war. You just need you need a conflict. But if we bring troops to Venezuela, that's going to be a mess. I don't know that it would justify. I don't think reasonably, but reason doesn't always prevail. I don't think reasonably it would justify martial law in the United States if we were to have a military action in Venezuela. But I understand why the listener would make those conclusions. It just seems like we aren't clear about what our aims are there. And for someone to assume what the listener just suggested is as reasonable as all the other hypotheses that have been floated? What is the end game here, other than maybe to disrupt the criminal activity that's going on in Venezuela? And, you know, that might be alone the reason, but it's not clear. We don't understand what's going on. Why are we about to go to war in Venezuela? I mean, I just think people are asking that.
I think it's the oil. I think it must be the oil.
Yeah, but, you know, the problem is, from an economic point of view, if we somehow change the dynamic and we suddenly have access to cheap oil from Venezuela, it's going to really hurt Texas, because Texas is already suffering because of its oil is so low in price, it's not even worth it to go to drill anymore. I mean, the price of oil is down. I guess from the long range, it's great to have a source of oil. One thing that did make sense was that Venezuela is a source of oil to China, and maybe disrupting that is part of it.
I think denying it to others is as important as
others who we're not friendly
with.
But again, tell us, why are we there? What are we doing? Is it to stop drug boats from coming to Miami? No, it's not that.
And Congress needs to be. I mean, I think was it you? Who mentioned like the oversight, and this is there should be some kind of hearing into this, which is the normal way of operating, right?
I know.
I want to see why haven't there been more discussions about this by congressional leaders?
And we're in the upside down world. They control the House, like, and the Senate. Why not take it there and just get it rubber stamped and move on? Like, why not?
Because it would have to be discussed, and then it would be a one by one vote, and people would. I don't know that they'd have the numbers in the House. I mean, people, you know, it's such a slim majority in the House, and there are still Republicans in the Senate who are very uneasy about U.S. foreign policy, the way it's being promulgated by Trump. Who knows? But even just to have the hearings that would and the congressional process to go through before you'd vote on authorizing military action in Venezuela, it could really disrupt the whole effort. You doing it unilaterally works so much better. I mean, these dictators, they have such a better situation. I know Trump envies them, you know.
The other aspect of this that I think we're going to see more of, some of the implications are on the Operation Sempo for the U.S. Navy. So there have been, you see this in occasionally in the headlines, there have been a larger number of firings of naval leaders in the past couple months than has been typical. And sometimes people are removed for so-called, you know, lack of confidence in their leadership. That's sort of the wording that's used. But the Navy in particular is being pushed to its limit of what it can do operationally around the world by Trump administration policies. And these the stress comes out in various ways, some of it by leaders who have to push. So I'm sure we'll be talking about that more.
Yes, let's come back to that after the break. But we are up against one. That's Malia Dumont here with Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Mike Spain. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue. You can email us, panel@wamc.org. And we will return after news with Ray Graff. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, here with Malia Dumont, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Mike Spain. The email address that you likely already know if you listen regularly, panel@wamc.org. We do have some email about the Venezuela attacks, but let us go back to Malia. We interrupted her for the break, talking about the Navy.
Oh, yeah, just to finish my thoughts. So one of the key responsibilities of any military commander is to ensure the readiness of their unit. And readiness has many different aspects. Personal readiness of each military service member includes everything from they got to make sure they have their recent glasses prescription, all their immunizations, like their dental checks, and their will is in order. Like, everything has to be in order at all times, so that if you are called to go to war tonight, you are ready to go. But the commander also has to oversee the readiness of the equipment. And in the Navy, that's the ships. And ships require a lot of time in between their deployments to for repairs and upgrades and all that. So usually the schedule is 6 month long deployments. And so this is the reality of life in the Navy, is that people, sailors, go away for 6 months at a time. They're they have limited communications while they're away. The op tempo that is being pushed by these recent actions, that that the U.S. presence in the Pacific, which is to a great extent a Navy presence, we have ships that are patrolling and just active in the Pacific all the time, and that's part of the deterrent against China, is now being augmented by these additional actions, a lot of which are Navy-led, in the Caribbean and near Venezuela. And so I'm concerned about what it means for the overall readiness of our Navy. And as I said before, we've seen some firings in recent months. I think that individual commanders are under a lot of pressure. Our sailors do a terrific job, but it's a lot for the service to absorb at once. And I think the Navy is sort of bearing the brunt of some of the Trump administration's policies right now.
Well, as you say that, though, we never cease to fund our military.
Right. Yes.
Just buy some more ships and, you know.
Some of the most expensive things that you can buy in the military. And I think, didn't he, Trump just announced last week, like some new ships that are named after himself, of course. Shipbuilding is important to the economies of several states, some of them in our listening area. Mm-hmm. So it's a large, complex issue. But as someone in the military myself, I think about the impact on the individual sailor, and I'm concerned about that.
I have a question, Malia. The firings or the reassignment or the forced retirements of Navy officers that you alluded to, is it because they may have raised questions or contradicted their officers, what usually leads to that kind of a thing within the military when someone retires kind of quietly, unexpectedly like that? What's generally behind it? Were they dissident? Did they express questions?
I think that would be highly unusual. Mm-hmm. What I think happens, it's not that someone is expressing discontent or dissent or anything like that, but Sarah's right. We don't. There's no like public official record.
Of course.
Well, if someone is removed from a command position, usually what's put out in the news is lack of confidence in their ability to lead, and that could be
anything
from inappropriate relationship with a subordinate, which is actually not that uncommon. Maybe they push the rules a little bit. This is what I'm part of what I think is affecting Navy leadership is that the increased op tempo is creating pressures on commanders to get things done on a time frame that isn't really reasonable. I think they're under a lot of pressure, and the pressure has to come out somewhere, and it's not great. All these enormous investments in the military don't usually show up in sailors' pockets. I mean, they will get, I think, a pay raise this next year, a small pay raise, but these huge military expenditures are usually on things like huge new ships or new weapon systems, in the end, it's the humans who run the place, and so I'm concerned with the humans.
Raymond writes in and says, "Guys, it's illegal to commit extrajudicial killings. It doesn't matter whether it's on U.S. soil or internationally. The only way, under our legal framework, under the United Nations Charter, that a state can use lethal force against members of another state is in self-defense, and when the Security Council authorizes it. I think we got skewed in our thinking after 9/11 and we started assassinating people even though it was against international law. Trump assassinated the Iranian general in his first regime and there's no declaration of war there. Somehow it seems easier to accept when the targets are Muslim, Arab, or Iranian. I don't get why there's not even more outrage against these extrajudicial killings."
Well, I'll go back to Sienna's question. Where's the congressional oversight?
Mm-hmm. And Deb wrote in and said, look at what you're talking about. Whatever they're doing or about to try with Venezuela, we're already being distracted by the horrible things this administration is doing, immigration, or not doing, keeping America healthy. That from Deb. And our final letter on this says, this is from Tom. They want Venezuela for the same reason they're obsessed about Greenland. It's a strategically significant. Venezuela and Florida create a choke point into the Gulf of Mexico. And then Mexico, all caps, emphasizing.
Right. Yes. We all know that's the name of it. Yes.
The Gulf of Mexico.
What's that guy work for, the Associated Press or something?
Speaking of immigration, which Deb, the listener, just wrote in about as something we do, of course, need to be paying attention to and not distracted from. This article from Christmas Eve, but we haven't talked about it in the past week. The Trump administration is seeking contractors to help it overhaul the United States immigration detention system in a plan that includes renovating industrial warehouses to hold more than 80,000 immigrant detainees at a time. That's according to a draft solicitation reviewed by The Washington Post. Rather than shuttling detainees around the country to wherever detention space is available, as it happens now, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement aims to speed up deportations by establishing a deliberate feeder system, the document says. Newly arrested detainees would be booked into processing sites for a few weeks before being funneled into... This language is so dehumanizing. Before being funneled into one of seven large-scale warehouses holding 5,000 to 10,000 people each, where they would be staged for deportation. Let us discuss recent developments and local affairs as it pertains to this, Sienna.
I started by saying that, you know, they were detaining individuals over the holiday last week, and it was very upsetting, families calling, looking. That's what people are doing now. They're looking for their family member. And so I'm not surprised by this. You know, what we're seeing right now is we're seeing more than, if you are just give you some logistics of what's happening. If you are a female here in the U.S. and you're detained, it's harder for them to find a place for you to go. Right now you're being housed in probably a portion of a jail facility, moving around. They're looking for places to put the females because in upstate New York, our main detention facility is in Batavia, outside of Buffalo, New York. And that has been converted to full, all male. So it's all males there. So it's a little bit harder for females. I'm just telling you what the logistics look like, because that means if you're detained as a female, it's hard for me, even as your legal representative, to find you sometimes. I don't know where you are. And we're trying to find them via the ICE locator, which is an online service they have. You put in their number and their country of birth, and sometimes ICE will upload where they are. But other than that, we don't know where individuals are. And they could be in New York today, and in 2 days they can be in Texas, or they can be in Florida. And so I think we're not, as a legal community, immigration legal community, we're not surprised by this, because we have been seeing this issue with them being able to house, especially our female detainees. That's what we're seeing. And this is hurting my heart. I want to say on the record that what's happening, but, you know, I'm just speaking about the logistics of it and what's happening, just to give you a feel for why they have this need for this. And furthermore, it's because of how they're picking people up. We have to say that. They're picking people up. They have policies in place they're rolling out. They're picking up people as they go to their immigration offices to get their papers correct and to try to fix their status here in the U.S. They're picking up people at the immigration courts. And one of the most heart-wrenching things that are happening right now for us in the immigration community is individuals that are in immigration court filing for asylum. The government counsel is terminating their cases and saying, hey, you don't need to file for asylum here in the U.S. We have a cooperative agreement with this other country, and that means that you can go to El Salvador and process Uganda your asylum case. And so judge, terminate their case, we're going to remove them to Uganda, where Uganda is going to process their asylum case for us. That's what we're dealing with on the ground right now, in terms of people in immigration court who are moving forward their asylum case, and then we can't bond them out. Like, the case law around getting someone out of these facilities has become so narrow that the places where we're going now as attorneys is we have to go to federal district courts. So that means when you move that person around to different states, now as an attorney, I can't represent you in Texas in front of the federal court, whereas I could have represented you in immigration court in Texas, right? And so now we have this immigration network. It's wonderful to see, and we're coming together. Is anyone can do a habeas in Texas? Anyone can do a habeas in California? And that's what they're doing. That's their strategy, is to move these people, these humans, you guys, humans around all over this country faster than you can turn your head, and it denies their right to due process. And then they're also removing them to third countries, which makes it very, very sad. So that's what we're dealing with in immigration right now. And that's what's so heart-wrenching about what's happening.
Do you have a sense of numbers? I mean, just like in the capital region, you know, I mean, are these happening every day?
They are. I don't want to give exact numbers, but we're hearing about, I don't even talk about the calls that come to our firm. People, mm-hmm. you know, and it's in the 20s. I mean, that's a lot just for us. So mm-hmm, you can imagine mm-hmm. who's going to the other legal organizations, but they're picking them up. People are, when you go to ICE, usually individuals with families, females with children, they do check-ins. They go in and they check mm-hmm. in with ICE, and ICE lets them go while they're pursuing their immigration court proceedings, and they're being detained. Mm. People are going to court and they're being detained, you know? And so what we're seeing is we're trying to like figure out their patterns. And what we're seeing is that they start to do a policy in one area and they see how it works. So they'll start to pick up people at one local USCIS office, for example. And then when they say, okay, this policy is working, then they'll roll it out to the rest of the country. And that's how they started with the third country removals. They started with one court, like you put this motion to terminate, let's litigate it, see how it looks, let's appeal it. And then once they did it there, now they're rolling it out all over the country.
So they fly people to Uganda or El Salvador?
Uganda, El Salvador, yeah. I think Ghana is on that list. You know, and these countries have these cooperative agreements where they're purportedly going to allow this individual to pursue their asylum claim in that country, not to come back to the U.S., in that country.
And it's baffling, but when they get to Uganda or step off of plane in El Salvador,
they're their own sovereign. So how do we know that they will even get those? They will be able to apply for asylum, or that their rights are? We're tracking them. They're trying to track them on the ground right now to see what happens when they go to those countries. I think the only thing limiting them is that the countries only take a certain amount, right? So like I think Uganda said 10 to 25 per month. Right. So like that's what's happening there. But these judges are closing these cases and ordering them there. And the idea is that you will go there eventually.
If that's the outcome when someone shows up to legitimately try and straighten out their immigration status at an immigration court and they're fearful that they're going to be basically taken into custody and sent off to a country on another continent. Wouldn't that keep some people from showing up and then therefore complicating their own case and putting them in violation because they didn't show up for the planned?
Exactly.
I mean, it's almost like a conundrum.
Yeah. And it's all about numbers. Like, as you said, like, it's about numbers. Of course, if ICE can't find these purported criminals, foreign national criminals, it's hard to get those warrants and to go find them. Mm. Why not just go to the place where they will come affirmatively coming to and pick them up from there? And that's what they're going to do. And they're picking them up from there.
And they've done it in a really cynical way, too. I mean, I'm very familiar with this because not just we have a student who's been in ICE detention for over 2 months who was detained.
It has been that long, hasn't
yes.
it? Oh, my goodness.
He was detained on October 14th when he went to a USCIS facility mm-hmm. For an immigration appointment on October 14th. And the appointment went well. Like, they didn't snatch him right away. He passed the appointment. They said, great, you know, and sort of gave him, you know, checked off that next thing on the list for him to pursue his asylum case. And then he was detained by ICE anyway. His lawyers immediately filed a habeas mm-hmm. Petition in federal court, which we're still waiting on a judge to just take any action on this habeas petition. We at Bard, you know, we have little leverage. What leverage do we have over ICE? But But we immediately became part of an effort to help organize sort of a publicity campaign about this, because this is not right. This is someone who is on full scholarship at Bard, an incredible person, majoring in computer science. He worked part-time as a security guard at the local hospital. Every other member of his family already had asylum. They're doing great things in the local community. Just a wonderful, wonderful family from Afghanistan who had worked with U.S. forces. In fact, this student has a certificate of appreciation signed by a U.S. Navy officer thanking him for his support to a U.S. effort in Afghanistan. And he's been in detention anyway in a horrible, horribly run privately owned facility that is contracted by ICE. These are terrible, terrible places. They have a website, and the website makes it look all cheery and sunshiny, and it is could not be further from the truth. I've visited there. It is hell on earth, and it's just unconscionable. So our student has had the benefit of more support and more publicity than practically any other detainee around. He's been on PBS NewsHour. We were able to get a story in the New York Times, the New York Post, the Guardian. We've had Republican and Democrat lawmakers make public statements, and he's still in detention. Mm-hmm. So all this effort has not yet resulted in his release. However, his asylum case is still... hasn't been canceled yet. It's still moving forward.
So that's the next piece, right? Like if he entered after, I think, November 2019, then he could be subject to this this asylum cooperative agreement. And that's their new route. Like, no, listen, the detention, we get it. They're detaining individuals to encourage them. It encourages them to want to leave, right? That's the idea. You want them to stay detained so that maybe it will make them take voluntary departure or take a removal order and leave the country. That's the idea. We saw this in the first administration. This new asylum cooperative agreement, where you're sending people to another country to be adjudicate their asylum claim, that is
despicable.
Despicable.
In our students' case, they're arguing that he has no need for asylum because Afghanistan is safe for him to return to, which is that's an interesting.
You'd be surprised what they do. Yeah. I mean, it's just...
Well, the story in the Washington Post talks about how they're basically, the U.S. government, ICE, is going to buy 23 industrial warehouses, literal warehouses, and convert them into facilities to house, in some cases, up to 10,000 people in them, each one of them, so they can have places for 80,000 people. One of them is supposed to be in Chester in Orange County, in this Hudson Valley region, at least. And it just shows that this effort to seize people who are not from this country and send them away is not anywhere near finished. It's continuing. And
dehumanizing as
dehumanizing is a good word. Yeah.
And it's not, even if you try to step back from the dehumanizing aspect of it and say, it's not helping our economy in any way.
Like
you just noted, all these individuals who have pending applications, they have work permits. They're working legally. They're legally authorized to work in the U.S. They're contributing somewhere. They're paying their taxes. And it's just you're swiping them up, taking away and leaving all these vacuums of in these corporations. I haven't had so many employers come to me and say, this guy was a good one. I'm like, yeah, this guy was a good one, I'm sure. But to say, basically, I don't know where I'm going to find workers. I don't know where I'm going to find someone to do what this individual did. And I'm not referring to just like blue-collar work. I'm talking about at all different levels. This is hitting us in the H-1B aspect, where you have, legal immigration. We're having them be, we're seeing a lot of that there as well, and them being issued notice to appears in court. So it's happening at all different levels, and people don't realize that foreign nationals are at all different aspects of our country, and they are embedded in our country, and they are a crucial piece of it, and we're missing out.
Yeah, I was at my mom's house in Maryland this past weekend and helping her clean out some old files, and I found among these files my great-grandfather's declaration to it was Declaration of Intent, I think is what it's called. It's a beautiful signed thing with a seal on it. He came to the United States from Hungary at the age of 22, and this document leaves out that he is declaring his intent to become a citizen, and he's renouncing his allegiance to the King of Hungary at the time. He signed this in 1910. This is the original document. And I just felt it was a wonderful piece of history that was in my mother's basement. I'm like, I'm taking this. I'm going to frame this. I'm going to put it on the wall. It's just part of, I mean, everyone's
it's
American
part of this
story.
Country.
Yeah,
it's, what,
yeah.
It's the story of this country.
Yeah, exactly. I want to, if we have a moment, I just want to introduce the listeners to an organization that has become pretty important to me over the past couple of years. It's called Afghan Evac. Now, people from many countries are being impacted by Trump administration policies. I'm particularly interested in those from Afghanistan because I served there myself. I have an affinity for that country. And Afghan Evac was started in the wake of the fall of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, and largely by U.S. military veterans. And it is a wonderful resource. And one of the programs they've set up is called Battle Buddies. I've signed up to be a battle buddy. And what they do, among other things, is when an Afghan who is applying for asylum has an immigration court hearing, Afghan Evac will send military volunteers to be there and as silent support and to demonstrate the level of community support for these people. Mm. They've got a great website, and they are very outspoken in what the in the damaging impact of these policies. And I'm on their, I'm on a Signal chat with them. And so on Christmas Eve, the head of Afghan Evac sent out a note to everyone. Oh, ICE is calling all these Afghans in. They have to report at 8 a.m. tomorrow on Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. They were scheduling immigration check-ins for Christmas Day and New Year's Day when courts are closed, specifically in order so they could more easily, quickly, efficiently detain people because legal recourse is less available to them on those holidays. Mm-hmm. And so there were battle buddies, largely U.S. military veterans who care about this, who showed up on Christmas Day, on Christmas morning, to be there with those Afghans as they went to their hearings. And it's a wonderful organization. I just encourage people who are concerned about these issues to check it out.
I will say, just real quickly, the only reason why individuals, when they do those ICE check-ins, get to walk away is because they may not have the beds for them. Like, they may get there and they might, we can't book any more people. Just logistically, we can't take any more people. But once these warehouses are in place, they won't have that issue. And so then we'll see that they'll be able to book them, and we're going to see a very bad poor result happening with a lot more detentions of a lot more people, including children. I need mm-hmm. to say that. This includes children.
Panel at WAMC.org. We are in studio this morning with Malia Dumont, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Mike Spain. You can join the conversation by sending us an email, panel@WAMC.org. We will be back with more after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, here with Malia Dumont, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Mike Spain. You can email us, panel@WAMC.org, if you'd like to join the conversation. We heard from Justin, who says, I was going to produce a litany of events, but your panel just did, regarding deportations, so I'll just put this label on it. It's ethnic cleansing. More broadly, this administration is ecocidal, homicidal, and genocidal in what it funds and incentivizes and does, and the world needs to freeze us out. That is from Justin. Michael wrote in and said, when will ICE get around to, quote, detaining MS-13 members after all the dangerous daycare workers and the day laborers at Home Depot are ended up just asking for a friend? That obviously cynically sarcastic, permissible tone on the show. And Carolyn says, why don't we call the warehouses what they are, junior concentration camps?
They literally are warehouses, and you can certainly appreciate how basic and Spartan they'll be, and the fact that they're planning 80,000 people to be in these just shows you the level deportations that the Trump administration is planning for 2026. And I mean, and didn't ICE just authorize purchase of a bunch of airlines so they can just stop using commercial airlines and just fly people to these these countries that will take and process, allegedly, I say process with air quotes, requests for passage back into the U.S. It's like ICE has all the money in the world to do all this stuff, and everything they're doing is not making our country better.
You know, one of the things I observed when I was visiting our student at the detention facility is this: it's an inhumane place for the people who are detained there, but it also is corrosive for the people who work there. And I noticed that the people who are running the place seem to be they didn't have any special skills. It doesn't require a high level of education. It's local, relatively poor people who are taking a job opportunity that then puts them in a position where they are acting inhumane towards other people. That's the job requirement. I felt like I was inside a Kafka novel when I was in that facility. And these folks aren't even armed. It's fear that keeps everyone in line there. And these private security guards who it's the job available in this community where the detention facilities tend to be put in communities where there aren't a lot of other opportunities. So it does create jobs, but they are, as I said, morally corrosive and don't offer any real skills or opportunity to the people who take them.
Denise wrote in and said, is it possible to have Zoom meeting check-ins for the immigrants? Thank you for the informative panel.
Zoom meeting, especially in these newer facilities where they're putting them, it's hard to schedule. Like, as a legal representative, it's hard to schedule time to speak to them. They are able to call out, but some of these facilities don't have proper phone systems yet because they're newer. The ones down south, the ones that he just put up, don't have proper phone systems. So it's very hard. Once in a while, what you can hope for is that a detainee will call you or call a family member whose number they memorized, which is important, right? Or write a number on your arm. I know it sounds crazy, but you have to know your number because sometimes they can call out. That's the best they can do. I've been telling, everyone's like, what's your advice? What do you tell people? I said, I know that your immigration status has always been something personal that people keep kind of to themselves as they go through life. They don't talk about it often. But I was like, in this climate, you need to have a community. You need to have people that know what you're going through, what your alien number is, because you can be taken literally off the street. You don't know where you will be, and you can be picked up and detained, and you need to be able to, for someone to say, hey, I haven't seen person X in 3 days. Where are they? Because that's what we need right now. We need a community. And that's what Malia was saying. It's only a community that gets that behind you, that pushes you out sometimes and can, like, find you. And sometimes if you can get a habeas file fast enough, they can kind of give a TRO so you won't leave that area. You can be stuck in that area rather than moving you all around the country. So we just have to be careful because in 2026, it's going to be a ramp up, especially with the midterms coming. I expect that if Congress shifts, there's going to be some more oversight that happens with ICE and what's happening. But until then, they're going to kind of try to pick up as many people as they can.
What is a TRO?
A temporary restraining order.
Thank you.
And just to clarify, a writ of habeas corpus is a request before a federal judge?
It's federal, yes, it's federal. And federal district judge.
And it's to demonstrate why this person cannot be released.
Exactly. Or, control over the body is as it says. But it's about, so for us, we always say habeas can be filed typically for prolonged detention. So if someone's been detained over 6 months. Or habeas can be filed for, medical, if someone's not being treated in humane conditions and things like that. But it has to be filed in the district where their body is, where they are. And that's what makes it so hard. So if you take someone from New York and you put them all the way in Florida, now we have to find a Florida attorney who's admitted in that district to file that habeas. And then if you're putting them in these, like you said, these areas where not many people practice, like in the rural areas, then how many attorneys do work in that area, right? So it's all strategic.
Is there, for the detainees, for these human beings in warehouses or whatever restraining place? Is there a hotline they could memorize and call for help if they can't, if they haven't memorized?
Oh, that's a good question.
Different phone numbers?
I don't know a hotline. Do you know, is there a hotline?
I mean, what you're saying is the reality that we don't remember phone numbers anymore.
Right?
We just tell Siri to call Cousin Bob, you know?
I mean, yeah. It sounds, literally, a lot of these detainees are, what they say to me is that I found a nice ICE officer. They let me look at my phone, right? Yeah. Like you're looking to the humanity of the officers in these facilities to make sure they get a phone call to their family, to make sure that they get access to the phone. If they don't, if this person is combative or is upset and they get on the wrong side, then no, they don't have access as quickly. Yes, they might be moved. And that's the scary part, is that you're at the whim of this institution and they're just moving you around, these humans around, and they control whether you're free or you're not.
So I don't know about larger organizations, but in terms of hotlines, I mean, in where I live, we have the Ulster Immigrant Defense Network, and they have they work with attorneys, they support the local community, and they're a great part of this community that Sienna is talking about. So there are I expect there are similar organizations in various places throughout the listening area, and I just encourage people to become familiar with those organizations, because the community needs to extend to all of us if we care about this. There are various ways that we can support people who are going through these processes.
And every ICE facility has a list of nonprofit organizations in that area that was issued by the Department of Justice. They should be handing those out as well, with phone numbers on it.
Panel at WAMC to join the conversation. That's panel at WAMC.org. Our panel this morning, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain. We're going to take our final underwriting break of the program and rejoin you with another topic or two, depending on time. You're listening to The Roundtable. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel for the 30th of December. I'm Sarah LeDuc, here with Malia Dumont, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Mike Spain. We're going to discuss Elon Musk. In July, Elon Musk announced the creation of a new political party, the America Party, widely seen as a rebuke to President Donald Trump as part of his feud with Trump. At that time, President J.D. Vance started working the proverbial phones to mend the rift between President Trump and Elon Musk. The months-long offensive by Vance and other White House officials, the details of which had not been previously reported, appears to have worked. Having scrapped his third-party project, Musk appeared at the White House in November, attending a dinner for Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. The killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk also spurred Musk to put support behind GOP campaigns in the midterms. Though Trump and Musk are once again on good terms, their truce is fragile, allies of both men say. Musk and Trump forged their relationship around a set of shared aims, winning an election and trimming back what they saw as government largesse. But there were deep gaps in their mutual understanding. Trump's camp was surprised at the speed and brazenness with which Musk inserted himself into the government, commandeering computer systems and email servers to briskly uproot federal agencies, his moves to dismantle the U.S. Agency for International Development, and his willingness to take shots at anyone, including Trump's cabinet members. Though Musk is unpredictable, he's also a formidable ally with formidable funds. With his nearly unlimited resources and unmatched digital megaphone, he could provide a powerful asset to the MAGA movement once Trump leaves the stage. Vance in particular stands to benefit. Though the falling out between Trump and Musk dominated the headlines, Vance's role in the reunion highlights his own relationship with the billionaire, and he talks regularly with Musk, according to sources, and Musk allegedly sees Vance as a viable 2028 candidate for president. Can you believe that Doge and all of those firings was this year?
Wait, say that last bit again. What about
that Musk sees
Musk's guy in 2028? Maybe it appears that he's ready to throw his money behind J.D. Vance for president in that election.
But so much can change.
Yeah.
These are incredibly mercurial people.
Yeah.
I mean, goodness. All right. Yeah. So Doge firings were this year,
right?
Yeah. And then a feud and now a reunion, all in one year.
So
much happens.
A lot happens. You know, the New York Times just did a big piece on how effective DOGE was. You know, there was supposed to be a cutting $1 trillion from the U.S. budget, but of course, it came way, way, way woefully low from that amount. And even Musk has acknowledged that. But the other side of it is that he has DOGE was successful in kind of restructuring the way a lot of things are done in government. You know, the combining of computer databases, getting information on people, using it to, you know, push out people all across levels of government. I mean, you know, and it's just become very easy to target people and do that now. And they have the mechanism to do that. And that may be the lasting impact of DOGE. And it's just a tool now that the Trump administration can use to reduce government. The odd thing is, at the end of the year, our budget, I mean, the tax cuts that were extended indefinitely are going to cause $1 trillion deficits going forward. So
I think that's an understatement, right?
Yes, right. So cutting a couple of hundred million it was probably closer to 100 billion. I mean, we're talking numbers that are astronomical, but cutting $100 billion from the budget, and a lot of these agencies have hired back people. A lot of people have who left government have gone on, and other people had to be hired in order for these agencies to function. It's really, I'd say, a mess. But the important thing to remember is that Elon Musk has so much money that he can really tilt the outcome of state elections, congressional elections, and even possibly the national election. He can put so much money in. There's no limit as to how much money he puts in, because the Supreme Court basically removed the law that had been established to limit campaign contributions. So that's the scary thing. It's how much money is going into these political campaigns.
When forced to think about J.D. Vance at all.
I apologize.
That's okay. when forced, I have a very, like, a simple view. I just think of this as this weird, like, bro thing going on. And I almost wonder, did J.D. Vance overplay his hand a little bit? Walk with me. I was reading this, and I was like, it seems like Musk likes J.D. Vance. So does Erica Kirk. Not that I'm messy, but
a little messy.
His boss is going to get upset with him.
Where I'm going. It's like, now it seems like J.D. Vance is trying to steal a little bit of the light from Trump, and is saying that J.D. will run a 28, and you know, Trump has a 2028 hat. So I was like, I wonder if it'll cause any, like, you know, disruption between J.D. Vance and Trump. And that's where I leave it. I don't try to overcomplicate their relationship with Musk, Vance, and Trump, because I don't think they overcomplicate it, and I can't.
Well, Sarah, you said it. Look what's happened in just 1 year.
Exactly.
And it's
exactly
a couple more years before the next presidential campaign, so a lot can happen.
Oh, man. No.
I just, in terms of DOGE, I'm from an institution. Every institution of higher education was impacted in some way by the basic dissolution of the Department of Education, the removal of lots of federal grants. I'm trying to still understand why I think some of these efforts, this project, this DOGE project, actually still is supported by a lot of people across this country. And I think it comes down to a continuing sort of increasing basic distrust of government, the lack of trust in what the bureaucracy is supposed to be doing. So it's better just to get rid of it. We don't notice the Department of Education is gone, I can hear some people saying. So why did we need to be paying for that in the first place? So I think it's just important to remember that there are a lot of people out there who see these, who won't quibble over $100 billion or $1 trillion. They'll see that as an accounting error. It's more about the philosophy behind it
a
lot of people continue to support.
Yeah, and to completely eliminate the Agency for International Development, like they did. And all of the programs that were going on across the globe that were life-saving programs, in order to, you know, a lot of people, it's like they didn't know what it was before, and they don't feel any impact of it at all, and they don't sense any impact of it. And, I mean, I think that's the importance of journalism, is to underscore. Just like there was an anecdotal story the other day that in the U.S. they developed a very inexpensive toilet system that could be sent to underdeveloped countries that would greatly help stop the spread of disease that's caused by the, bad...
non-containment of waste.
Right, non-containment of waste, exactly, and sewer systems not existent. And the U.S. Agency for International Development was rolling it out and making them available. I think they were like $67 or something each, one of these systems that had enormous impact, and just stopped. It just stopped, and nobody has picked it up, and maybe eventually somebody will, but it's no longer happening, and that's going to have an enormous potential now lost in helping people avoid disease and really all the things we take for granted, that are just not existent in parts of the world.
Can I share a very quick, I don't know how close we are to end it.
You've got 4 minutes.
Oh, 4 minutes. Okay. I just wanted to share a very quick good news story. Towards the end.
Right. I don't know.
It's like, Malia. Let's end on up note. So we have a number of students from Ukraine at Bard. And one of my students from Ukraine has gone home to Kyiv over the Christmas holiday, and one of the things she had to do while she was there was get her U.S. Student visa renewed.
Yes.
And I'll make this a shorter story by just saying it's an extremely complicated and challenging process because of the situation in Ukraine. And I have been on the phone, on Zoom meetings, texting, calling with her almost every day, and I just got a text from her that her visa was approved.
Nice.
So, yes. So
she'll
be coming back. Yes. I'm very relieved. This is. I'm going to try to maybe bring her up here to be a guest on
Please
the air
do.
With me one of these times. She's a wonderful young lady. Extremely talented. Like all of our students are, and very very committed. And it's just, this is a testament to her personal perseverance. And we're lucky to have her. We in the United States are lucky to have her wanting to come here and be part of our community, and we're lucky to have the opportunity to give her that that opening. So just wanted to share.
Yeah, no,
thank you for sharing.
Nice,
congratulations.
It's nice to hear good news. I wish I felt optimistic about the outcome of this Trump meeting with President Zelensky from Ukraine that happened over the weekend or over this week. And it's just it's a grim outlook. I'm lacking any hope that there's any progress.
Yeah. Yeah. It can feel monumental when we're talking about building warehouses for 80,000 people. And then my good news story is one person getting a visa. The scale of it is just monumental. But this one person might make the difference. And, it's like we have to find those bright spots.
We really have to.
Yeah.
Speaking of defunding of many organizations throughout the country, we, of course, mentioned USAID and lots of other things, the Department of Education, the Department of Health.
Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Yes. Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We lost funding this year, as did many other public media entities throughout the region. And we would like to encourage you to donate to your favorite not-for-profits at the end of the year. It's very important to support the causes you believe in. If one of those causes is public radio and WAMC specifically, please feel encouraged and free to support us online anytime at WAMC.org. Thank you, panel, for being here today. Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. Always appreciate you, Malia. Partner with the Albany Law Firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert. Same to you. And Mike Spain, our stalwart our perennial hero.
Long timer.
Very much appreciate you always and your perspective. Former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain. This has been the Roundtable panel for this morning. More show to come, and we'll be back tomorrow. You are listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.